Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, the latest developments reported at the 35th Annual San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. And this is an annual workshop that we have every year, and this is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 1,151 participants, and you come from all over the United States, many different regions of the United States and areas, and we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, Belgium, Bolivia, India, New Zealand, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world. Today's program is supported by funding from Genentech. It's also funded by support from Novartis Oncology, and we really want to thank them for their support of our program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. Julie Grelow. Dr. Grelow is Professor, Medical Oncology, University of Washington School of Medicine, Jill Bennett Professorship in Breast Cancer. She's Director of Breast Medical Oncology, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. And Dr. Grelow is going to put this program in a context and really talk a bit about the conference and the symposium and the research findings and treatments reported at the symposium. She's going to discuss biomarkers, targeted treatments, and diagnostic technologies, and advances in breast cancer clinical trials and research. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Grelow.
Great. Thanks, Carolyn, and welcome to everybody around the world who's listening to this program. We're trying to hit some of the highlights of the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium and some abstracts that can have direct clinical relevance, meaning we can use the results now to help patients who are battling breast cancer. So every year, for 35 years, in early December, we've had the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. And what makes this conference unique is that it really is a blend of the basic science with a very clinical piece. And we call that translational. So taking kind of even some lab, you know, bench researchers, and then bringing clinicians who are treating patients, bringing them together and trying to blend that so that we get the best research and the best outcomes. I'm going to talk about four different presentations of clinical trials, and most of them are in the area of estrogen receptor positive, with the last one being a really cool new target added to estrogen receptor targeted therapy. And I start by telling you that estrogen receptor was really the first target that we had in treating breast cancer. We actually had tamoxifen around and were using estrogen receptor targeted therapies before we even knew what estrogen receptor was. And later we found out that there was this marker that told us who would benefit from hormonal therapy or who wouldn't. About 80 to 85% of breast cancer patients have tumors that express the estrogen receptor. And those rates are somewhat lower in developing countries and in younger women than they are in older women or in more developed countries. So the first abstract that generated a whole lot of press, it was in every newspaper, on every evening news, was a trial called the ATLAS trial. This was a trial of 10 years of tamoxifen in early-stage breast cancer versus 5 years. And this trial was a long time in the making. It's been going on for years and years. And what we saw was a presentation of about 7,000 women who had enrolled in this trial who had estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, early stage. They were being treated with curative intent. And about half of them had lymph nodes involved with tumor and about half didn't. And these women all got 5 years of tamoxifen. And then the randomization to continue or not happened at the completion of 5 years of tamoxifen. And the presentation reported on 8 years on average of follow-up from that randomization. So half the women in the study stopped taking their tamoxifen at 5 years, and the other half continued. And they're now reporting 8 years from the time of randomization. One of the first things that they told us when they presented this data was compliance with taking the drug after 2 years was 80%. So about 20% of women who were randomized to take longer tamoxifen were no longer taking their tamoxifen 2 years after that. So we have some dropout. And I think the women on this call all understand why they might stop taking their drugs. It might be because of side effects. It might be because they weren't convinced that it would do better. And so they kind of hadn't bought into believing that they should stay on it. There are lots of reasons why patients can't take drugs, and sometimes it's cost even of what the drug would be. So comparing the group that stopped their tamoxifen at 5 years with the group who continued out to 10 years, we saw a reduction in breast cancer recurrence in the group that took 10 years, and we saw a small but real reduction in deaths due to breast cancer for taking the tamoxifen longer. And we didn't see that occur right away. Even in the first 5 years after the randomization, there was not much difference between taking 5 years and 10 years of tamoxifen. But then when you started following women out longer, it turned out that the benefit really showed up at about year 10. And if you compare 5 years versus 10 years and you're now looking way out, well after they've even finished their 10 years of tamoxifen into that next 5-year period, you start to see on order of even up to a 30% reduction in recurrences for having taken longer tamoxifen. It just doesn't show up in the first few years. So what about side effects? Whenever we see small but real benefits from taking a drug, we have to weigh it against all the toxicities. What's very important to note is that in the presentation and then in the publication that went along with it, that these investigators only had access to side effects and toxicities that resulted in a hospitalization or a death. So they didn't have a lot of data, as we might collect in a clinical trial that we were doing in a more modern era, about, you know, side effects that didn't result in something serious like a hospitalization or a death. What they did report was that there were more blood clots that went to the lungs. We call those pulmonary emboli. There were almost twice as many blood clots that went to the lung in the group who took longer tamoxifen. There were more cases of uterine cancer. We know that that's a side effect of tamoxifen, and taking more tamoxifen caused more uterine cancer. Again, somewhere around almost a twofold increase of uterine cancer. And what we don't know is how many women got blood clots that didn't go to the lung, because that wouldn't result in hospitalization usually. How many women had poor quality of life due to hot flashes or vaginal symptoms? None of those things, because they wouldn't result in a hospitalization, were really accounted for. So how are we using this information from the ATLAS trial in clinical practice? Do all women now who start tamoxifen need to take it for 10 years instead of 5? And I'll tell you that I'm not routinely telling all of my patients that they should keep going on tamoxifen for 10 years. I think the first thing that we would want to say is that in 2013, for postmenopausal women, we're mainly using aromatase inhibitors instead of tamoxifen. So I'm not quite sure how to interpret this trial in the modern era, where the majority of my women are postmenopausal, and they're not even getting tamoxifen anymore in the early stage setting. They're getting an aromatase inhibitor. And we don't have any trials yet that tell us that taking longer aromatase inhibitors are better than just 5 years. What about premenopausal women where tamoxifen is still the standard of care? Well, if you finish 5 years of tamoxifen and you've become postmenopausal while you're on the tamoxifen, you might consider, if you were going to take more endocrine therapy, to switch to an aromatase inhibitor instead of staying on tamoxifen for another 5 years. And many years ago, we saw the reporting of a study done by the National Cancer Institute of Canada that showed that women who had 5 years of tamoxifen and then were randomized to switch to a drug called letrozole or Femara versus go on placebo at the 5-year time point did much better with the Femara. So if you've become postmenopausal where you're on the tamoxifen, that might be a strategy instead of staying on a total of 10 years of tamoxifen. And then we have to very carefully weigh a woman's risks and benefits. And there are some serious side effects of continuing the tamoxifen. So in a woman, for example, who had no lymph nodes involved, had a low risk of recurrence, I probably would view that the side effects of continuing the tamoxifen are probably greater than a small benefit in reducing residual risk of recurrence. And I'll also point out that in the ATLAS trial, when we looked at deaths, half of the deaths on the ATLAS trial were not even breast cancer related. They were just related to getting older. I mean, most of the women on this trial did not have a recurrence and did not have a death. And even those who died, half of them, it wasn't even related to their breast cancer. So we have to put that all in perspective. And then I would say, in talking with my patients about whether we should keep going on the tamoxifen or not, they have a lot of concerns about quality of life issues, the hot flashes and the night sweats and the insomnia and all, and that might be a reason to not continue on the tamoxifen. So there's a lot to deal with here, and I've spent a lot of time talking about the risk versus benefits, and I really think when I'm talking to a patient about how to use this data, it has to be individualized to the patient, and we have to estimate what's her risk of recurrence still versus being cured, and what's her risk of a blood clot or uterine cancer, what's her risk of heart disease or fractures and other things that happen to us as we get older. So I'm really individualizing, and I don't think that the conclusion should be that everybody needs 10 years of endocrine therapy. And I'm sure we'll have some questions about that. So moving on to the next abstract, which I'll just discuss very briefly, this gets to the next class of endocrine agents that we use in treating early-stage breast cancer, and those are the aromatase inhibitors. There are three out there, and they all show efficacy both in the metastatic breast cancer setting and the early-stage breast cancer setting. There was a trial called the Big 198 trial that compared one of the aromatase inhibitors called letrozole or Femara with tamoxifen. And a long time ago, many years ago, we saw that for postmenopausal women, the Femara, the letrozole arm, was overall better in reducing recurrences, not necessarily reducing deaths due to breast cancer, but reducing recurrences. The letrozole arm was better than the tamoxifen arm. But this trial also did some interesting half and half, so a few years of tamoxifen followed by a few years of Femara and vice versa. Anyway, what was new at the San Antonio meeting, since we've seen all the results of the tamoxifen versus letrozole, was they tried to pick out a population that did better on the Femara and a population that maybe didn't need the Femara, that tamoxifen worked just as well. And to kind of just summarize what was some very elegant research that was presented, turns out that tumors that we're now calling, we call them luminal A, they're estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, we're now kind of subdividing into a less aggressive type and a more aggressive type. So the luminal A's are the less aggressive estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. The luminal B's have some more aggressive features. And the conclusion of this biomarker analysis of the Big 198 trial suggested that if you had a luminal A type, a less aggressive type of estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, there was very little difference between receiving Femara or tamoxifen. But if you had the luminal B type, then the Femara was even much better in terms of reducing recurrences. Also, they looked at what we call an invasive ductal versus an invasive lobular type of breast cancer. Some of you may know that those are the two main subtypes of invasive breast cancer, and the majority of breast cancers are ductal. But some of them fall in this lobular category. So I'm sure we have some women that are listening to this who have had an invasive lobular. And what this study suggested was that the invasive lobular breast cancers did seem to benefit more from the aromatase inhibitor, the Femara, than the tamoxifen. There was a higher degree of benefit if you had an invasive lobular. So I'm not sure that this is practice changing, because at least in the United States, most of our postmenopausal women are getting an aromatase inhibitor. But I think in some other countries where we're still using more tamoxifen, even in postmenopausal women, this might help us decide who really should probably get the aromatase inhibitor versus which tumors are just fine continuing with tamoxifen. So the third clinical trial that we saw an update on was a trial called the CONFIRM trial. It was a trial of a drug that falls in the third category of endocrine therapy. So we've got tamoxifen, which falls in the selective estrogen receptor modulator categories, and then we've got the aromatase inhibitors. And then there's a third category that to date has really only been approved and used in treating metastatic breast cancer. And the drug in this third category that we use is called fulvestrant, or Faslodex. And the CONFIRM trial just looked at using two different doses of Faslodex or fulvestrant in metastatic breast cancer. We'd previously seen that the higher dose of 500 milligrams did better in terms of responses and the time until the tumor started progressing than the lower dose, which had originally been FDA approved. And this trial led us to actually change the dose of fulvestrant with the FDA as the package label. So this was really just an update and a confirmation that not only does the higher dose show an improvement in how long the patient can stay on the drug without the tumor progressing, but also that it looks like the higher dose leads to a better survival, a longer survival. So that was what was new on the CONFIRM trial and reported, and so we should all be using the new higher dose of fulvestrant, and I think everybody's pretty much changed their practice now. The last abstract I wanted to talk about is related to a new target that is called a cyclin-dependent kinase inhibitor. So the particular drug that was studied in this trial was called PD-0332991, which is a mouthful. It doesn't have a cool name yet. It's called a cyclin-dependent kinase 4-6 inhibitor. So this drug blocks cells at a certain stage of cell division. And the trial that we saw presented was an early phase 2 trial. So this is just kind of an early look at would adding a drug that hits this pathway, that hits this target, would it add benefit to endocrine-targeted therapy? So the trial was estrogen receptor positive, metastatic breast cancer patients. Everybody got endocrine therapy in the form of letrozole or Femara at the time of their recurrence. And then half the patients had this new drug that's got a bunch of letters and numbers that nobody can pronounce, the CDK4/6 inhibitor, and half of the group didn't. And what was reported in this early study where we really we had about 150 patients who were reported on to date was that the group of patients who had a recurrence of estrogen receptor positive breast cancer who were just starting endocrine therapy, the group that had this drug, the PD-991 drug added, did much better in terms of how long they could stay on this regimen without the tumor progressing. So this was an early phase 2 trial that we now will need to transition into a much larger trial to see if it holds up over time, but incredibly promising that by targeting not just the estrogen receptor in this population of patients, but a new receptor, a new part of cell cycle and cell division with this cool new drug that didn't add a lot of toxicity, this might be a new way to try to help metastatic patients with ER-positive breast cancer. So I'm going to stop right there. I know we'll have some questions about some of those trials, but we've got a few more trials that Dr. Shapira and Dr. DeMichel are going to review before we open to questions. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Grelow, for just a wonderful presentation and really for just the clarity of your presentation and helping everyone to understand a very complex topic here. So thank you so much, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Angela DeMichel. Dr. DeMichel is Associate Professor of Medicine and Epidemiology. She is co-leader breast cancer program, the Abramson Cancer Center, and Dr. at the University of Pennsylvania. And Dr. DeMichel is going to address triple negative breast cancer, quality of life concerns, and reconstruction. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. DeMichel.
Thank you so much, and I join the other speakers and welcome you all to the program. It's so nice to have you join us today to talk about these issues that that we heard about at the San Antonio meeting. So I'm going to talk about a couple of different areas. First, I'm going to talk about a drug called bevacizumab or Avastin. And there were two trials with that drug, one in estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, so we'll start with that. It's sort of a follow-on to what Dr. Grelow was talking about, and then one that was in triple negative breast cancer, and we'll talk a little bit about what's happening in triple negative breast cancer. And then there was quite a bit of new information for patients who have HER2 positive breast cancer, and so I'll cover some of the issues with that. And then I'll finish up with some information about some of the things going on for quality of life. So let's start with the bevacizumab studies. So again, this is a drug that's also known as Avastin. You may have heard of that name. And this is a drug that is designed to attack the mechanism by which tumors make new blood vessels. So we think that it's important for tumors to have a good blood supply in order to grow and certainly to make new blood vessels in order to travel to other places. And there had been a lot of information on this drug from animal studies and from the laboratory suggesting that this was really important. But the drug has encountered some difficulties treating patients, and so you may have heard about some of the controversy surrounding this drug in breast cancer. It's also used in other kinds of cancer. Initial studies in breast cancer looked very promising, and so the Food and Drug Administration, which is responsible for approving drugs in this country, initially said, yes, this looks like a very promising drug, and we're going to let people have access to it. But as you know, we do lots and lots of studies because we really want to understand whether a drug works or not, and we want to follow patients who are taking these drugs for a long time to really make sure that they're beneficial and that we understand the toxicities. And over time, several other studies were done that did not show as much of a benefit, and there were some serious toxicities, and this made the Food and Drug Administration reconsider whether or not they would approve the drug for breast cancer. So currently, the drug is not formally approved for breast cancer, but we continue to see studies that were started before that decision was made, and we continue to want to learn about this drug because I think all of us who treat breast cancer patients and who treated patients with this drug saw patients who seemed to benefit, and we'd really like to make sure that if there is a group of patients who benefit from this drug that we can find them, we can understand it. We certainly want to try to make it available if possible. So the first study I'm going to talk about was in women with estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. This is the same kind of breast cancer that Dr. Grelow was talking about. And these are women who had advanced breast cancer, so cancer outside of the breast and lymph nodes. And they were given the opportunity on the study to take either just the anti-estrogen therapy, and that could have been an aromatase inhibitor like letrozole, or it could have been one of the receptor blockers, fulvestrant. And so the patients were all placed on the anti-estrogen, and then half of the patients also were given bevacizumab. And they were continued on the study and watched until the disease progressed or the cancer got bigger or more widespread. And so on this trial, one thing that was quite remarkable was that in general, as Dr. Grelo talked about, we know that there are side effects to the hormonal therapies and that they can cause some side effects that are problematic. But most patients who take these drugs do very well and don't have a lot of side effects. However, the group of patients in this trial who also took the bevacizumab did have some serious side effects and certainly had more side effects than the patients who were taking the hormone treatment alone. There was more fatigue. There is a complication of high blood pressure that can happen with this drug, and that was seen. This drug can increase your risk of bleeding because it's affecting blood vessels, and there was certainly more of a risk of bleeding. And it can cause the kidneys to spill protein into the urine, and that was seen as well. So, of course, as we've talked about, you know, risks and benefits are so important to weigh, and there certainly were side effects seen here. When they then looked at how well the two groups did in terms of how long they responded to the therapies, it turned out that the group who took the bevacizumab in addition to hormone therapy did get benefit from their treatment slightly longer on average than the group who took just the hormone therapy, but this was not considered a statistically significant increase. This was not enough of an increase to say it could have just been chance alone. And so this was considered not to support the idea that bevacizumab was helpful in this particular situation. Now, there was a second trial that was reported, and this was in patients who have triple-negative breast cancer. And so in contrast to the type of breast cancer we were just talking about, where the tumor cells have receptors for estrogen and progesterone, and those tumors are highly hormone-driven, they need hormones to grow and divide, triple-negative breast cancer is characterized by the fact that there are none of those receptors on the tumor cells, no estrogen receptors, no progesterone receptors, and in fact, no HER2 receptors either. So triple-negative breast cancer is really named for what it's not, not for what it is. And it turns out that we're learning more and more about just what triple-negative breast cancer is. It turns out it's not just one kind of breast cancer. And so several of the studies that were presented at the San Antonio meeting were really studies of tumors, not treatments for triple-negative breast cancer. And in these studies, they would take a group of tumors from patients who have triple-negative breast cancer and try to understand what are the main drivers, what's turning on the motor of that tumor cell? Is it something having to do with blood vessels, or is it something having to do with the immune system? Is it something to do with the genetics of the tumor? And so what's evolving really is a understanding of different pathways and different targets that we think are going to be very important in triple-negative breast cancer moving forward. And so as we talk about new treatments, such as the one Dr. Grelo discussed, targeting the cell cycle, which is yet another potential target in triple-negative breast cancer, we're going to be talking more and more about drugs that are targeted to very specific genetic problems with these tumors or very specific processes that are abnormal in the tumors. This is likely to require that we do more involved testing of the tumor at the time the patient is diagnosed or even at the time of a recurrence so that we can really understand the whole molecular profile of the tumor. So we can really understand what targets are there, what targets aren't there. And as we test these new drugs, we'll be looking at the tumors very carefully to see if the drugs hit the targets and to see if hitting those targets really causes the tumors to shrink. So this is where we are with triple negative breast cancer right now. I think it's a very exciting time because there are numerous drugs that are being tested in this kind of breast cancer. I think what is frustrating sometimes is that those drugs haven't necessarily gotten to the clinic quite yet, but I do want to reassure you that there's a tremendous pipeline of drugs that are being tested in triple negative breast cancer, and our understanding of this type of breast cancer is growing tremendously. Now, the trial that was reported at San Antonio was using the drug bevacizumab, again targeted to blood vessels. And this was in patients who were newly diagnosed with triple-negative breast cancer. And in this study, patients were given chemotherapy in order to try to eliminate any microscopic cells. And they were given a whole wide range of different kinds of chemotherapy. And then half of the patients also got the bevacizumab with their chemotherapy and following the chemotherapy. And again, I think similar to the study I told you about a moment ago, there was more toxicity in the patients who got the bevacizumab over chemotherapy alone. And this toxicity was serious enough to cause patients to have to stop their treatment early because of serious complications. And certainly we don't want to add anything to the treatment regimen that makes taking the standard treatment difficult. So that was a problem in giving the bevacizumab with chemotherapy in this trial. And given just about 3 years of follow-up, it did not seem to prevent the cancer from coming back more frequently. So it did not seem to have a preventative effect by adding the bevacizumab. So this particular trial in triple negative breast cancer did not seem to support the idea of adding bevacizumab as a targeted agent. However, there will be other trials like this that are currently in progress or that have been completed, very large trials that are really designed very similarly, and we'll need to compare across those trials to see, is there some benefit to bevacizumab? And more importantly, is there a specific group of patients who have one of the targets of bevacizumab in their tumors so we can really personalize the use of bevacizumab and make sure that if we're giving it, and it does have side effects, we're giving it to the patients most likely to benefit. So now I'm going to turn my attention to several of the studies presented about HER2-positive breast cancer. So this is another target, another receptor on the outside of the tumor cell. HER2 is an important molecule because when it's stimulated by growth factors in the bloodstream, it sends a signal to the nucleus of the cell that the cell should grow, and that the cell should continue to grow and divide and spread. So HER2-positive breast cancers tend to be fast-growing tumors. And the good news is that we have now a whole different variety of treatments that are specifically targeted to that receptor, both in terms of blocking on the outside of the cell the ability of growth factors to stimulate the receptor, but also blocking on the inside of the cell that signal from going through to the nucleus. So the drug that we have been using the longest and we have the most experience with is the drug trastuzumab, also known as Herceptin. And we began to use this drug really in the late 80s, early 90s, where it became very apparent that in tumors that had a lot of this HER2 protein on the outside, there was a really remarkable response to this drug Herceptin, trastuzumab. And it also boosted the effect of chemotherapy in treating these cells. And over time, we learned that it didn't work just in advanced breast cancer, but that it also worked in women who were newly diagnosed, who were taking chemotherapy to prevent the cancer from coming back. So when Herceptin was given in addition to the chemotherapy, there was a substantial reduction in the likelihood of the cancer coming back. And so really way back in 2005, we heard the initial reports of how well Herceptin worked in preventing a recurrence of breast cancer. And that came from two very important nationwide studies that were done that compared chemotherapy after surgery to chemotherapy plus Herceptin. The chemotherapy was very specific. It had to include Adriamycin, Cytoxan, and Paclitaxel. Some of the women just got the chemo. Some of the women got the chemo plus the trastuzumab with chemo, and some of the women got the trastuzumab just after chemotherapy. So this year at San Antonio, now a full 7 years after those initial reports, we have the final reports from those very important studies. And in fact, with at least 8.5 years of follow-up, we do see that these benefits really do hold up, that giving the trastuzumab along with chemotherapy does prevent the cancer from coming back a significant amount of the time and does help women with HER2-positive breast cancer live longer. So this has been one of the best and most important advances in the treatment of breast cancer, certainly during my career, and it's very gratifying to see that those results are continuing to hold up over time and that we really are helping many women with this type of breast cancer. Now, another trial that came out around that same time was a European trial called the HERA trial. In that trial, actually, patients were allowed to get lots of different kinds of chemotherapy, and it was designed to show whether Herceptin added to chemotherapy was beneficial and whether you needed it for 1 year or whether even longer, 2 years, would be better than just taking the trastuzumab for 1 year. And so at San Antonio this year, we had an update on that trial that compared giving the Herceptin after surgery along with chemotherapy for 1 year versus 2 years. And the long and short of it is that 2 years was not better than 1 year. The patients who got it for 2 years didn't have significantly fewer recurrences, didn't live significantly longer, and did have more side effects. And so this trial really confirms our standard of care, which is to give the Herceptin after surgery for a year. And so that continues to be the standard. Now, there was another study that actually compared 6 months to 1 year of Herceptin. So we've got the one study comparing 1 year to two, and we've got the second study called FAIR that compared 6 months to 1 year. So could we get away with less Herceptin, even less than a year? And this trial, again, was in women who had non-metastatic breast cancer, who had had their surgery and were going to go on chemotherapy. It was a very well-designed trial because, of course, you really never want to think that you're shortchanging a patient from getting less chemotherapy and less of the Herceptin. When we do these large clinical trials, we do have groups that are monitoring how patients are doing. And as part of doing the research study, there are very specific times at which the data is examined to make sure that nothing unexpected is happening, to make sure that no one's getting hurt. And so this trial, it turns out, was examined at one of those early time points, and there was concern that they were not going to see an equivalence of 6 months to 12 months. So this raised a red flag, and the trial stopped. And the conclusion, although they didn't complete it, was that there didn't appear to be as much of a benefit from taking only 6 months of Herceptin as taking 12 months of Herceptin. Now, this is, again, just one trial. There are several other trials that are looking at this question, and we never really lay an issue to rest until we feel like we have definitive evidence. And, of course, there are patients who need to stop the Herceptin earlier than 1 year because of toxicities or problems with their heart. And we don't know that there isn't some benefit to taking it for less than a year. But this does, again, confirm that the standard of what we do should be to continue for 1 year. And so that was really all of the data that was on trastuzumab or Herceptin. Another trial that has looked at a way to target HER2 is with a drug called pertuzumab. And pertuzumab works like trastuzumab by blocking the receptor on the outside of the cell. And this drug was recently approved by the FDA and became available to patients. And that was on the basis of a trial called CLEOPATRA. So we like to name these trials. It helps us remember them. And in the CLEOPATRA trial, this drug pertuzumab was added to trastuzumab and a chemotherapeutic drug docetaxel. And so when they compared patients who were getting docetaxel and trastuzumab to those who were getting all three drugs, including the pertuzumab, turned out that the patients who got all three did better than the patients who only got two. So what was reported at San Antonio was whether we could try to figure out whether all patients with HER2-positive disease benefited from the addition of the pertuzumab, or whether it would be just a small subset. Was there something about the tumors that we could identify that would help us know whether or not a patient was going to respond to this new drug, pertuzumab? And what came out of this analysis, which was really a genetic analysis of the tumors, was that a mutation, a genetic change in an important pathway called the PI3 kinase pathway may signify a kind of tumor that's less sensitive to the pertuzumab. Now, this was preliminary data, and we're just learning more and more about this pathway and the different kinds of genetic changes that can happen. But the good news is that we have new drugs that are being developed and tested right now that target this particular pathway. And so even if it turns out that having a mutation or a genetic change in the PI3 kinase pathway makes a patient less sensitive to pertuzumab, we are likely in the near future to have other drugs that will specifically be targeted to that particular genetic abnormality. So that concludes what I reviewed on the tumors that are HER2 positive. And I just wanted to end then with a word about quality of life. You know, we know that many women who take treatment for cancer have very long-ranging complications, symptoms, and side effects of the treatment. And of course, you want to do everything possible to beat the disease and to get the most effective treatment possible. But I do see so many women in my clinic who have complications or symptoms that can range from anything from fatigue or hot flashes all the way to more serious problems from the treatment itself or side effects from the treatments that we're giving. And one of the things that we hear about a lot is some of the issues surrounding being able to think clearly when you're taking treatment for breast cancer. It's a term, chemo brain, that is sometimes used, and I know many of you out there can relate to this, where the feeling that's described by patients is that when they take treatment for breast cancer, they're unable to think clearly or to remember things or to do all the calculations that they typically need to do for their jobs or balancing the checkbook. And this has been a really difficult side effect or complication to really understand for us in medicine. It's not something that we can easily characterize. We don't have good tests for it, and we certainly don't have good strategies to try to prevent it or treat it. And so there was a presentation from a group at Michigan who started to do imaging of the brain in women who were undergoing treatment for breast cancer to see if maybe they could find changes in the brain that would help explain this phenomenon, why women were experiencing this. And I think what the take-home message from that study really was is that there were brain changes in many women who were taking treatment for breast cancer who had had breast cancer, but they weren't necessarily related to the chemotherapy. There were brain changes that happened in women before they even started any of their therapy for breast cancer. And those changes seemed to be correlated with having more fatigue and having more worry and having more stress. And so what we really need to try to tease apart is that the stress of going through the diagnosis of breast cancer can already potentially set up a woman for having more of these more cognitive or thinking problems and memory problems later on, and how much of this is something that we could handle before we even start treatment. How much of it is due to the treatment is something that we're trying to learn more about and trying to tease apart. But I think what it really points out is that having breast cancer is an incredibly stressful experience. It's very disruptive to your everyday life and to your everyday function, even without the treatment. And we need to be very proactive about identifying problems before they start and really getting support and care to those who need it. And with that, I'll stop and turn over to the next speaker.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. DeMichel, for a wonderful presentation as well, and also for covering a whole other set of areas that I know many women are concerned about, and also with highlighting concerns about cognition issues that many women report as well. So thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Lydia Shapira, and Dr. Shapira is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Staff Oncologist, Gillette Center for Breast Cancer, Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Shapira is going to address the role of neoadjuvant therapy, including radiation oncology, progress in the treatment of metastatic breast cancer, and treatment of special populations, including younger women and older women. And I now turn this program over to Dr. Shapira.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. It's such a pleasure to join all of you. Welcome to the call. I know I've learned so much. I'm sure you all want to get on with the questions, so I'll try to be quite brief. I'm going to cover a few unrelated topics in the next 10-15 minutes. The first really deals with a very common problem that we still haven't solved, and we heard a presentation at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium that probably will be the final piece of evidence that we'll see for a while that will help doctors and patients deal with a very difficult problem of what to do when there's a local or a regional recurrence of cancer. It's a trial that took many, many years to complete. It was very hard to enroll patients into this. It took place in many different centers all over the world, in Europe and in the United States. The trial is known as Calor, which for those of you who are Spanish speakers really means heat. But in this case, it was to look at the value or the role of adding chemotherapy once the recurrence has been resected. So this applies to those women, fortunately a small number, but a very important problem, who experience a local recurrence in the breast, in the area of the breast, or the regional lymph nodes, after having had successful treatment of cancer. And one of the big dilemmas facing doctors and patients with breast cancer is often to know just what is the right amount of treatment. Not everybody benefits from chemotherapy. We certainly don't want to miss out on the opportunity of helping anybody, but we also don't want to overtreat. So for years, we've debated whether or not giving chemotherapy to women who have a local recurrence is really going to impact on their outcome, on how long they live without cancer, on whether or not we can prevent them from having metastatic cancer, and whether we can even help them survive better and longer. So this study addressed that issue. It took a long time to accumulate the numbers of women that they needed, and in fact, they stopped before they could enroll the desired number of women, which they had targeted around 260, but they stopped when they had about 162 patients and reported the mature results. So we eagerly listened to this. And what they did in the study is they assigned women, again at random, to either receive chemotherapy or not after having a resection of their recurrence. The type of chemotherapy was left up to the discretion of the individual physician and patient. But what the study did show is that women who received the chemotherapy in this setting had a better outcome. So this is very important and now gives some evidence for those who are faced with these difficult decisions. And the group that benefited the most was, of course, the women who had hormonally insensitive disease, that is, women who could not go on to receive additional hormonal or endocrine therapy. So the result of the CALOR study will help inform decisions in practice of those women who experience the infrequent but very complex situation of facing a local recurrence. Another area which has been the subject of much attention and debate is just how long and how much radiation women need after having their initial surgery. So I'm not a radiation oncologist, but I am always interested in knowing just how long my patients need to be treated, and I know that we've gone from thinking that 6 weeks was the only way to do it to even considering very partial and localized breast radiation protocols, and that these are certainly the object of intense scrutiny and research. So at the moment, you know, the pendulum is swinging from very long to very short to somewhere in the middle. And again, I want to bring to your attention the fact that there was an important study presented that took place in the United Kingdom that showed that a shorter course of radiation using different doses or fractions of radiations that could be delivered in 3 weeks with 15 fractions was quite effective. So at least our colleagues in the United Kingdom are moving towards a shorter course, not the very, very short course that's being studied still in many centers around the country and the world, but certainly a shorter course. This may be very important, again, in terms of quality of life, because many women need not only radiation, but also some form of chemotherapy. And if you start to think about the time that women need to take off from work, or the degree of to which they need to give their lives over to receive medical treatment, these, of course, are very, very good steps, good efforts, and all going in the right direction. Again, perhaps sometime in the future we'll be able to personalize the recommendation for the exact dose and the schedule of radiation, but at the moment we now know that another shorter schedule has shown to be safe and effective. Let me turn now to tell you a little bit about a drug that received a lot of attention a few years ago, and that's a drug, a chemotherapy drug that we use to treat metastatic breast cancer, and that's a drug known as eribulin. It showed incredible promise a couple of years ago, and one of the reasons we were so excited about this drug and continue to be excited and use it is that it showed that it could be very effective even after other drugs had been tried in the metastatic setting. We often talk about lines of treatment of disease, and so this is a drug that was used in third or fourth or even fifth line. And what this study that was presented at San Antonio tried to do was to see if we could bring it up, if we could give it earlier and compare it to one of the drugs that we use very frequently, a drug which can be given orally called capecitabine, if it would be better than capecitabine used a little bit earlier in the treatment sequence of women who had metastatic disease. This is a phase 3 study, a large study conducted at multiple institutions, and they tested this drug, eribulin, against capecitabine. And I'll tell you right now, the long and short of it is that they didn't show that eribulin was superior. That doesn't mean that it is not a good drug and not effective. They just didn't show that in that setting it was superior to the capecitabine. So perhaps many of you have some questions about this drug specifically, and we'll be happy to discuss that later on. At the moment, I would say that it's getting the right kind of attention. We are still trying to figure out exactly where to fit it into our lines of treatment, and perhaps, again, there will be a time when we'll know exactly who will benefit the most. But it's still an incredibly helpful drug, even though in this particular study it was not shown to beat capecitabine, which is an older tested drug that has been enormously helpful. I certainly have used it a lot in my practice, and I know that for many women, it has offered an option for a drug that they can have control over because they take it at home, that is very effective and, in general, very well tolerated. So I want to talk about a couple more things. And the first is, again, a very practical question, which is this. As we are encouraging more women to receive some form of chemotherapy first, before they have their definitive surgery, we are often struggling to know just how much surgery they'll need in their axilla, that is, in the area under the arm where the lymph nodes that drain the cancer are typically found. So we have a pretty good idea that we just need to sample the sentinel node when we do a typical breast cancer operation. What we are less clear about is how to use the sentinel node and how that information can guide us when a woman has already received chemotherapy. So these days, for instance, there are many women who at the time of diagnosis, they have a kind of cancer that perhaps is very likely going to respond well to chemotherapy, and there is some nodes that are felt in the axilla, and perhaps they'll just have a core biopsy or just a fine needle aspirate procedure that is simpler, and that just confirms that they have involvement of the lymph node in the armpit or the axilla. And that so then a recommendation may be made to start with chemotherapy. Now, many women do that and have a very, very good clinical response. In fact, the breast cancer shrinks and the involvement in the lymph nodes appears to disappear. So the question is, how much surgery do they need after they've had their chemotherapy? This is a very, very hot topic for surgeons. So at this meeting, there were two studies, one from the American College of Surgeons through what is now a collaborative group called the Alliance, and one from Europe. And the results were a little different. The American study was presented by Dr. Bowie from the Mayo Clinic, and she was able to show that a very large number of women who had initially involvement of the lymph nodes all of a sudden cleared their disease. And she asked the question, perhaps we could just limit the role of the surgery in those cases and just confine ourselves to sampling the axillary, the sentinel node. So she did a very, very good study where she looked at women who just had the sentinel node and axillary lymph node dissection to try to see how many times they missed the diagnosis if they just did the sentinel node surgery alone. And what they came up with is that the results were not as great as they had hoped. There were the false negative rate, as it is called, was a little bit higher than what they had wanted to see. It was in the order of 12.5%, and they were hoping to see only about 10 or 10.5%. But when they started to account for certain aspects of the procedure, just as how the things such as how many lymph nodes had been removed and whether or not those lymph nodes showed any chemotherapy effect and what kind of methods they had used and whether or not an initial clip had been placed, they came up with the fact that perhaps for many women, just removing that sentinel node after neoadjuvant chemotherapy, if they had had a very good response, might just be sufficient. This may sound confusing to some of you, but perhaps very familiar to those who have struggled with these decisions. The aim, again, here is that for those women who are going to go on to receive radiation and those who have had great response to neoadjuvant chemotherapy, perhaps may be spared longer, more extensive, more disfiguring surgery that could also put them at risk for more complications such as lymphedema. The German study, unfortunately, did not arrive at this conclusion, so we must say they had higher rates of these false negatives, and they didn't really think that the procedure itself was reliable. So we have to wait. It's always interesting and tempting when you just first hear something presented to think that now you know how you're going to act. So we'll have to wait and see until we see all of these studies reported and published and we can really analyze the statistics. But I think that for most of us, and certainly for most of the surgeons working in multidisciplinary teams, especially in the U.S., the question is now really very mature and should be asked, and that is, you know, can we really limit the extent of axillary surgery for some women who've had very good responses to preoperative chemotherapy. And finally, since we are running out of time, I just want to make a few comments about how age impacts on our treatment of cancer, both for the very young women and perhaps some of the older women. We had an incredibly thoughtful presentation, perhaps not a new science presentation, but a great presentation at San Antonio from Dr. Moss, who gave an overview of just how we should all think about age and old age in particular in helping our patients make the right treatment choices, since sometimes some of the treatments that we use may be more disabling or may have more toxic effects on some of the older patients, and perhaps they may require some tailored treatments. For the young patients, we often worry that we may not even be giving them enough treatment, or we may not be giving them exactly the right kind of treatments. And we are hungry looking for more information. Well, Dr. Loibo, who is a German oncologist, presented a large statistical review of 8 large studies done in Germany of preoperative chemotherapy, which is, again, something that's becoming more and more popular. And she tried to see if there were specific patterns for women who were under 35, so really young women. And it's exciting to see that data is emerging. It appeared that the biology of the cancers in the very young women may be slightly different. It looks like there are more very young women who have triple negative cancers, which we've known, and also luminal A cancers, and that they are quite likely to respond to chemotherapy. So this is also going to be something that we'll keep hearing more and more about, and we all look forward to studying the publication when it comes out. But the bottom line, Dr. Loibo's message and her conclusion, which I think deserves scrutiny and follow-up, is that perhaps the very young women have cancers that are more sensitive to chemotherapy, even those who have hormonally sensitive cancer, that for them, chemotherapy really has great value. So I'm going to stop there because I've gone over time a little bit and turn it over to Caroline.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Shapira, and you're excellent and a really wonderful presentation and the time well spent. We really appreciate your covering broad areas that are very important to our participants. And our next speaker is Ms. Christy Case. Ms. Case is an oncology social worker, and she actually is at Cancer Care. She is our clinical coordinator for women's cancers at Cancer Care. And Christy is going to address the free psychosocial support services offered by Cancer Care, as well as the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Christy.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you so much for all of the doctors who have spoken so far. I know I've certainly been learning quite a bit as well, so I'm hoping that all of the listeners out there have been learning. And as Dr. Messner mentioned, I will be addressing the importance of having support and how cancer care can provide that for you. So as we've been learning from today's workshop, there's been a lot of discussion on treatment options, subtypes of breast cancer, clinical trial information, also the mention of quality of life, the stress, and the importance of having good support while you're undergoing cancer treatment. And many times there's so much information that it can be really difficult to understand what does this mean for you. So Cancer Care is here to help you to understand, you know, what does this information mean for you and how does this impact your life. And we are trained how a diagnosis of cancer really affects a person, their family, their partner, and their friends. We are also trained to help people with cancer and their families tackle the challenges that come along with a diagnosis, such as the real practical and financial demands, the physical changes, side effects, the social adjustment, and the psychological impact that cancer has. And we're here to help you learn how to cope with how to adjust to your life with cancer, because this is an important part of your journey, and we don't want you to cope with this on your own. And as I had mentioned, we help in many ways, practical support and financial help. We're also able to connect you to a variety of financial assistance resources. And our emotional support services are provided in a variety of settings. So we provide telephone counseling. We also have online and telephone support groups to make sure that the support that you need is really accessible for you. We do realize that cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. So for asking for help by contacting one of the cancer care social workers with either having counseling or possibly joining a support group, it's really a sign of a strength. And through our counseling services, what you're afforded is really the time and attention to discuss what your individual needs are, what your concerns are, and what your questions may be. And counseling can really help you explore the tools that you need in order to effectively cope with your diagnosis or your loved one's diagnosis. For many people, when they're affected by cancer, talking to a social worker really just relieves them from a lot of the stress of holding all of this information inside, holding in all of your worries, or, you know, having to shield their loved ones from their diagnosis and their cares and concerns. And with our support groups, we also offer a wide variety of those as well. So we do offer support groups for people with cancer, but we also offer the support groups for family members, partners, caregivers, and loved ones. And many times people find being in a support group is a really wonderful way to connect to others who are going through a similar situation and are dealing with similar struggles. And some of the support groups that may be interest for you is we have wonderful telephone and online groups for people with breast cancer. So individual counseling and support groups are really a safe place where you can talk about your concerns and fears. This can really help lessen the connection, this could improve the connection and really lessen the isolation that many times people feel going through this. And when you're feeling emotionally well, it can really help you better deal with your diagnosis and the treatment that you're facing. One of the wonderful things about cancer care is all of these support services are provided completely free of charge. We are always seeking people that are interested in our support services. So if you feel that this may be helpful for you and are interested in calling, you can just call our toll-free helpline, which is 1-800-813-4673, or you can also visit our website at cancercare.org for more information. And in addition, as you know, our Connect education workshops provide both specific disease information, like today's workshop, and also many workshops that discuss the physical and emotional impact of cancer. We also have fact sheets and booklets, and these are packed with up-to-date information so that you can be well-informed about your options. And these are just two additional tools that can help you. And again, all of those materials are also provided completely free of charge. So the message we want you to know today is that just to remember that you are not alone. Cancer care services are here to help you. I certainly hope that each of you have found this workshop today to be beneficial and informative, and I really appreciate your attention and the opportunity to speak with all of you today. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Chrissy. It was a wonderful presentation. And also just, you know, your eloquence in terms of describing the services that we offer and that they are free and that to please take advantage of them for everyone on the call. And now we have time for questions. We have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to try to take as many questions as possible. Stephanie?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Lynn F. Your line is open.
Thank you. Dr. Grelo, thank you for your presentation on the ATLAS trial. One of my quick questions is for women who fall into that category of youth using tamoxifen prophylactically, specifically BRCA-positive people, should they also contemplate continuing on tamoxifen beyond the 5 years and go with 10?
Well, thank you for that excellent question, Lynn. Dr. Grello?
Well, great question, and we have absolutely no trial data that answers that question. In the prevention setting, we just don't know the optimal duration of tamoxifen. I don't think that the ATLAS trial advises us at all in that setting. And I'm sorry to kind of give you an answer of I don't know, but all the prevention trials to date have stopped at 5 years. So it's a tough one.
It's an excellent question. I guess it's an area that will be researched into the future, do you think, Dr. Grello? Do you think it will be something that will be presented at future meetings?
I don't know of any ongoing trials looking at longer duration of tamoxifen in the prevention setting, and those are big trials, and funding for such trials is kind of low now. So I don't think we're going to see trials that are powered to show a difference. I don't know, Dr. Shapira, do you know of any work in this area?
I agree completely. No, I don't think there are any ongoing long prevention studies for all of the reasons you mentioned. And in addition, it's very hard to justify giving a medication that could potentially cause long-term side effects when there's no disease to treat, when you're just doing it to reduce the risk of a disease. So I don't think there's a lot of enthusiasm for launching such a study.
Excellent. Well, thank you. That's an excellent question and excellent answers. So thank you. Our next question?
Our next question comes from Christy B. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. The coverage of the phase 2 trial with the kinase inhibitors, that was for women in their first line of treatment. And I was wondering if there are any similar trials looking at cell division drugs associated with metastatic women in their second, third, or fourth lines of treatment. And if not, I guess a question would be, how can metastatic women influence that to happen?
Thank you. Yes.
So this gets to the CDK4/6 inhibitor trial that I discussed. There absolutely are trials going on in women beyond first-line treatment, at the time of recurrence, and we just haven't seen the reporting. This was kind of unexpected that this trial would be as positive as it was, but there are other similar drugs in this category, and there are definitely multiple other trials going on, including after a couple of lines of endocrine therapy, et cetera. So these drugs are just starting to be developed, and they're being explored in a variety of areas, and not just in endocrine estrogen receptor positive breast cancer either, but in other subsets of breast cancer. So over the next couple of years, we're going to see a lot more data on these types of drugs.
Excellent. Our next question.
Our next question comes from Linda A. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to have you address more the HER2 negative, triple negative metastatic breast cancer, specifically the drugs and trials, if you know of any after the surgery, the initial surgery, chemo, radiation, and additional surgery after it metastasized to her lung.
Dr. Shapira,
and also, if you could touch on chemo brain.
Thank you. Okay. Dr. Shapira, could you address those issues?
If I understood that correctly, that was a comment on drugs that could be useful to treat triple negative breast cancer that has metastasized to lung.
Yes.
And the second part of that question was also talk a little bit more about chemo brain. So the first part is, I would say, first thing to do is to try to figure out what drugs have already been used and consult with your oncologist or with your friend's oncologist to see what drugs are available that work for triple-negative breast cancer and also what kind of clinical trials. I think you were looking for innovation, at least that's what I heard into your question. So new drugs are available through clinical trials, and exactly what kind of clinical trials you or your friend are eligible for, that's the word we use, so the ones that you would qualify for, the ones that could help you or help your friend, depend a lot on the particulars, on what the state of health is, what prior drugs have been used, where the tumor is located. So there's no one answer I can give you. There are many, many clinical trials going on now looking at innovation, looking at these new drugs, and the which one to match you or your friend to depends very much on the particulars of the case. So I can't quite come up with one answer that perhaps meets your needs, but I would suggest that you discuss it with your oncologist and that you go to a center where they specialize in breast cancer and new drug development, and that they help you find both some standard drugs perhaps and also some innovative treatments for your friend. The issue of chemo brain was beautifully covered before, and I think that it is such a hard area to discuss in general terms, because what chemo brain may mean or how it's interpreted by each individual is so very different. There are clearly some problems in thinking that arise as a result of having had the experience of breast cancer. How much is due to the trauma? How much is due to the treatment? How much is due to the drugs? And how much a woman recovers is very variable. So the most common problems that women describe are difficulties with word finding, so word retrieval, difficulties with calculations, and difficulties with what we call visual spatial orientation, means the ability to read a map or orient yourself in space. And then some of these things can also be affected by how much sleep one's had, by how distracted or anxious one feels, and perhaps even by medications that are being used in order to help deal with some of the most common side effects of chemotherapy. And these medications often make one sleepy or make one lose focus. So there are many things that go into this very horrible term of chemo brain, but they all have to do with how sharp we are, how focused we are, and how much in control we are of our thinking. The recovery depends very much on the individual, my recommendation for anybody who's experiencing this is to try to be as precise as you can and discuss it with your team, with your nurse, with your physician, and be consistent about it and try to work with them to try to see how much you can improve, go over the medications you're on, go over your lifestyle, the amount of sleep you're getting, the amount of help you're getting to deal with the complex emotions, and then give it time, because sometimes these things resolve not just with weeks or months, but even with years.
Thank you. That's excellent. Thank you. And there's a question from one of our online participants, from Leonard Christie, actually, and the question is about the difficulties of people seeking counseling. Do you find, Christy, that people have a hard time seeking counseling or help due to their being perceived as kind of needing help? Is it something that you find that people are having a hard time asking for help? Christy, could you address that?
Sure. And Leonard, that's an excellent question. In my experience, most of us are more than likely led to believe that asking for help is perceived as a weakness, and that we don't need help, and that getting help is kind of more of a luxury, when in reality, as human beings, we all need help and support in our everyday lives. And when you are dealing with something like cancer, whether you're the person diagnosed or your loved one is, everybody needs support, whether it's from the doctors, the nurses, the social workers, family members, friends. And many times there is a stigma about seeking out counseling. And what the wonderful thing is if people are willing to give it a try, I think most people find that it's a wonderful addition to their life because it really affords you the opportunity to have some time for yourself, to really learn about what works for you in terms of your coping style, really helps you get a professional perspective about what you may be going through. And many people find that they just find so much comfort in knowing what they're going through is really normal, is actually really healthy, and that there are ways that you can feel better emotionally. And so if you're on the fence about it, I would say to give it a try. It really may make a big difference for you. So thank you.
Thanks very much. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Maureen M. Your line is open.
Yes. In terms of individuals who are HER2-positive metastatic disease and have been using Herceptin, but there seems to be some advancement in the cancer, I know that there was a drug talked about at the conference that should be used or could be used instead. Can you address that?
Thank you, Maureen. Dr. Grelo, would you want to address that?
Sure. There are multiple HER2-targeted agents now approved. After trastuzumab was approved, the next HER2-targeted drug approved was lapatinib or Tykerb. It's a pill, and it targets both the epidermal growth factor receptor as well as HER2. And it was approved after a tumor had progressed on Herceptin in combination with a drug called capecitabine or Xeloda. So that is one option. The drug pertuzumab or Perjeta, which is one that Dr. D. Michelle mentioned, is currently only approved in the first-line setting of HER2-positive metastatic disease, and it's given in combination with Taxotere and Herceptin. And although there are a few phase 2 trials that show that adding pertuzumab to Herceptin after a tumor has progressed on Herceptin has benefit, the drug is not approved in that setting, and I've tried to get it approved after progression on trastuzumab or Herceptin, and I have not gotten a single insurance company to approve it yet. So while there is some data on using it in the setting that you're describing, it is not approved there, and it's a very expensive drug, and most insurance companies aren't approving. There's now a drug that we expect will be FDA approved, momentarily, certainly within this month, and then it might take a couple more months to be available, but it's a drug called TDM1. And there wasn't a lot of new information on TDM1 at the San Antonio meeting because we had seen it presented at earlier meetings in 2012. But this is actually Herceptin that is linked to chemotherapy, a very toxic chemo agent, with the idea being that the Herceptin will take the chemo directly to the HER2-positive cancer cell, and this drug has been studied after progression on Herceptin and shown to be quite favorable, and actually the pivotal trial shows it to be better than the combination of Xeloda and Tykerb, which is currently approved in that setting. But TDM1 isn't yet FDA approved. There are some expanded access trials going on in the country, so some patients might be able to access it in that way. But we do expect it to be FDA approved in the very near future.
Thank you. We have a question from Carol, one of our online questions. If you have been on an aromatase inhibitor and it stops working, can you go back on it at a later time, i.e. following a stretch with another AI, or is it once and done. Dr. Shapira, can you address that?
Interesting. So we typically don't go back because once we find that disease seems to grow in spite of a drug, we assume that the disease is resistant. So we typically move forward. But since there are quite a few aromatase inhibitors, we sometimes try one if another one has stopped working. In particular, we try the steroidal aromatase inhibitor, exemestane or aromacin, after the disease has progressed on letrozole or anastrozole. But we don't typically go backwards, to answer your question.
So, and if I can jump in here, While I entirely agree with Dr. Shapira's response, there was an interesting trial that led to the approval of a drug called everolimus or Afinitor, where patients whose tumors were ER positive and had progressed on one of those non-steroidal aromatase inhibitors, Femara or Arimidex, were then tried on the third aromatase inhibitor, the steroidal aromatase inhibitor, aromacin, and they did a trial of adding this Afinitor or not, which is an mTOR inhibitor. That's its target. And they found that, so after progression of the tumor on one of the non-steroidal aromatase inhibitors, adding a steroidal aromatase inhibitor and then adding this mTOR inhibitor, Afinitor, they actually got some pretty good responses, and that led to the approval of that combination after tumors in the metastatic breast cancer setting had already progressed on an aromatase inhibitor. So that's not quite the same as just switching to another aromatase inhibitor, but in combination now with another target, we have a new approved regimen.
Excellent. Well, I actually want to thank all of our speakers. You've really just been outstanding, really quite a team, I have to say, really excellent. And I want to also thank all of you who have asked questions both on the telephone and online. This has been an extraordinary call. We actually had this call last a bit longer today because it is such an important topic and there's so much to cover post-San Antonio. I recognize that there are questions that we have not gotten to, and I want to remind all of you that you can access, you can call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE, and our staff are here to answer your questions. Most importantly, as we conclude the program today, I don't want anyone to feel you're alone in coping with breast cancer or with cancer in general. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support, and we're here to help you. And I think you heard Christy describe all of our services that you can access, and we want you to really take advantage of them. So call us, try us for different things that you might need. Also, the other resource that we also give out in all of your materials is the National Cancer Institute. They have wonderful information specialists who can answer your questions. So that you can contact that number as well. So I hope that it's 1-800, the number 4-CANCER, and that's a wonderful resource as well. So I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.